Well, he's batting 500. He got the name right, but I ain't from Raleigh. I am from North Carolina, though. My name's Tom Ivester, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's great to be here. I get an opportunity to share every once in a while with my fellow alcoholics. But there's no place that I'd rather share that means more to me, that's more important to me, than in this kind of a setting. And that ain't just something nice to say to get off to a good start. That's the God's truth. Because I think what we're doing here tonight is at the very heart of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where I want to be. And so I'm delighted to be here with you, privileged and pleasured, really, to be in your midst. I want to welcome you. Let me ask you this. I was just curious. I met a few people. How many folks are attending the area assembly for the first time? If you would just stick your hand up. Outstanding. Outstanding. Well, we sure want to welcome you into this aspect of service and guarantee you that this will be an exciting, rewarding, meaningful kind of experience. I want to welcome you to the assembly. I want to welcome you to Macon, Georgia. Sound like the host. Yeah, this welcome you to your assembly. I really want to welcome you to Macon. This is the second time I think I've been here for an AA deal. And last time I was here, I got acquainted with this city a little bit. And if you haven't done so, I would really, really encourage you to take a look at Macon, Georgia. I really think it's one of the best-kept secrets in the country. I didn't realize this, but Macon, Georgia is the location of the greatest number of registered historic sites east of the Mississippi River. And it's an absolutely delightful place to just wander around and take a look at. Absolutely beautiful stuff that's underway. When I take a look at those old houses being restored, it reminds me of me. Yeah, so I want to welcome you to Macon and encourage you to take a good look at this while you're here. I tell you what I basically want to do tonight. I basically want to tell you one drunk story. And yet there's a little more to it. I've got three things in mind. I can always come closer to getting somewhere if I know where I'm trying to go. And let me tell you where I want to go tonight. You know, they say we've only got one story, and that's certainly true. But it's amazing how differently it comes out. Tonight what I want to do is I want to spend a bit of time letting you know that I belong here. Yeah, I won't tell you something about drinking liquor and throwing up. I just believe in that. I love hearing about it. I love talking about it. I ain't somebody burned out with drunken logs. God, I love them, especially mine. So I don't want to minimize the importance of that. So I want to get into a little bit of that. So you know you didn't get somebody in the wrong flock. Then I want to talk a little bit about the state of the art in terms of our program and where I see it. You know, and I want to talk about that a bit because I know that those are things that are close to the hearts of folks in this place. And then I want to wind up talking about the real joy of recovery, which I think is based in service. And so that's really what I want to do tonight. That ain't planned or organized. That's just sort of where I'd like to get going. I'm an alcoholic. I'm absolutely convinced that I'm an alcoholic. I wasn't born that way. I just got that way real quick. I got off to a lousy start. I was born up in South Carolina, very close to Georgia, and had a lousy beginning. I got scarred up pretty good as a kid. I got burned deeply with religion. I formed a real kind of uncomfortable relationship with anything spiritual. I developed early in life a tendency to bury things and not to open up and not to share with anybody who was about. I got into a family that today they call dysfunction. My dad just run away from home is what happened. There wasn't nothing dysfunctional about it. He just left. And I grew up in a kind of an awkward sort of development, a kind of development where I lived a kind of dual existence. One was how I felt on the inside. The other was how I acted on the outside. And I was the kind of guy that would go through the motions of being a hail fellow well met. I was the kind of guy that would go through the motions of seeming to be comfortable with people. But on the inside, I was a guy that was locked into isolation. I was a guy that found it very uncomfortable to be in social situations. I was a guy that was very slow to form relationships, very slow to form friendships, very slow to trust anybody. And so I grew up with that kind of an awkward, uncomfortable relationship with life. And that was plaguing to me up into my teenage years. Then I discovered a thing called booze. And when I discovered booze, I discovered the absolute magic. When I took my first drink, it did for me exactly what those promises that Mike read talked about that day. And it was as natural as anything I've ever done in my life. Nobody had to teach me how to do it. I didn't do it as skillfully as I came to do it later. Some of it came out of my nose and my eyes watered and I coughed and gagged and was not a suave, debonair fellow at all. But it was natural. It was as natural for me as breathing. It was just like that. Because it fit right into my life comfortably and naturally. And what it did was gave me exactly what I needed to deal with the discomfort, the fear, the isolation, the separation that I felt from other people. And it gave me the sense of confidence, poise, well-being, so that I could participate in this thing called life. And I loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved it because, just like Silkworth said, essentially because of the effect of alcohol. God, it did something great for me. And I loved that stuff. I loved everything about it. I loved the bottles they put it in. I loved the people who drank it. They just seemed to me a bit more exciting than other people. They still do. Drunks are still a kind of an exciting commodity. You never know what they're going to do. They don't know what they're going to do. Yeah. I loved the places people drank. Yeah, I loved those cool, dark caves with carpet and organ music and somebody like Gay playing rinky-tink piano. Yeah, I loved that kind of place. And I loved the kind that was sort of typical for where I grew up with dirt floors or what looked like dirt floors. Folks fighting in one corner, making love in another one, dogs running in and out. Kind of place that never threw anybody out. The worst thing that could happen to you was get thrown into one of those places. And I loved those places. I just loved the excitement. I loved that sort of air of expectation. Yeah, I loved that notion that there was some mysterious something going to happen there. It never did happen where I was. It was always at the next place. But there was an expectation that was there. I loved the music and the scuffling and the dealing and the wheeling and all of the junk that went with it. Loved that kind of lifestyle. It did a lot for me. You know, I was a guy who found complete release and freedom and euphoria in booze. My God, I'd have been stupid not to drink. And it did a lot for me. Cheapest medicine I ever had in my life. And God, that stuff just worked for me magically. And it always did. It always did. You know, It always gave me exactly what I was looking for until the last drink I took. Now, the last little bit of it, it gave me a lot more than I wanted. But it always gave me what I needed. It was the most reliable friend I ever had. So I loved it. I loved the release. I was basically a sort of problem-ridden kid who drank too much. That's essentially what I was. I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't born alcoholic. I wasn't an instant alcoholic. I was a problem-ridden kid who solved his problems very effectively with alcohol. That was true with me until, now I recognize this looking back, but I recognize that my drinking changed in my 18th year. I don't remember exactly when. There was no bell went off, no light lit up, but I could recognize when I got into program and looked back that in my 18th year it changed. Nothing dramatic. Now, I dare say that I drank no more the day after I became alcoholic than the day before. But I developed the disease alcoholism. And I'm not going to dwell on this much, but it's an awfully important distinction for me to understand. that when I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm not just saying I'm a guy who drank too much, that I was a guy who was a problem drinker. I'm saying that there is something physiologically different between me and other people. Now, I think alcoholism is basically three-part disease, the way it's described in our books. It's essentially a spiritual dilemma. It's a mental obsession. There's something about my mind that causes it at times to turn irresistibly to the thought of a drink. And even though, it ain't been as long as Joe Phelan, but even though it's coming up on 36 years, I fully believe that if I took a drink in Macon, Georgia tonight, the odds are very, very slim that I would get back to North Carolina at all, or certainly in any condition. There's something about my mind that makes me well aware that that could happen to me tonight in Macon, Georgia. I could leave this meeting or during this meeting have a revisit with the obsession. Now, I don't expect that because my thinking is relatively good right now. But I recognize that there's something about my mind that causes it, if I quit practicing these principles, to revert to what it was like before, and the obsession to return. It's something peculiar. I don't react normally to alcohol. I'm not somebody, I don't think I'll ever be somebody who has a rational reaction to booze. Now, I'm not somebody who goes around smelling folks' breath or checking their glasses, but I'm not a casual observer. I watch people drink. When I go to a party, I go to a party when I'm trapped. And I stay till I hear the third joke, or the same joke for the third time. Then I know it's time to go, and they ain't even going to miss me. They won't even know I'm gone. And I watch folks at parties. I like to watch the guy that polishes the drink off, and then stands there awkwardly with an empty glass. I hate to watch the yo-yo who gets a drink and swizzle sticks it to death. God, drive you crazy. And I'm not like that. When I'm on an airplane, and the guy next to me, when they give free booze, and the guy next to me turns it down. And I always wonder, how come? In fact, I ask people sometimes, why didn't you take the booze? I don't drink. How come? That's totally abnormal. I know why I don't, but if I could, God would I. it's a peculiar thing about how I react to booze. So that's part of it. It's a spiritual dilemma. It's an obsessive way of thinking about alcohol. And then in my 18th year, the thing happened that closed the deal so that I was never to be the same again. There are a lot of ways to describe it. I personally like best the description that's in the third chapter, third paragraph, of the more about alcoholism, where it's got one line that I like. It says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And I like that definition. If you like a real Wild West macho description, read the preceding paragraph. If you like one that's got a lot of blood and guts and gore in it, read the next one. I like that one. I like it because it's a straight-up matter-of-fact statement. It has nothing to do with how much I drank, when I drank, who I drank with. It has nothing to do with whether I'm young or old, rich or poor, smart or dumb, religious or not. None. It says that we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's exactly what happened to me. Even though I drank too much, I think up until that point, I was basically a troubled young man who solved his problems with booze, did it very well, drank too much, drank like a fish. But in my 18th year, I crossed that line. And I became a man who was incapable of controlling my drinking. From that day to this day, if I took one drink of anything with alcohol in it, the results were only predictable in the fact that they were unpredictable. God only knew what I would do because I didn't. And I did not understand what had happened. I had no earthly idea. I was typically the kind of guy that would be drinking in Atlanta with a guy like Pat. That's hazardous duty in itself, that just but Pat, and he just the kind of guy would do it, say, hey, Todd, there's something going on in Rome, Georgia. Or Italy. It wouldn't. Why don't we go? And my response would be, let's go. And it didn't matter what my situation was. And I would wake up a few hours or a few days later and go through the same stupid routine time and time again. Well, you've done it again, you sorry devil. And that's really what I thought the issue was. I thought I was a guy that was just sorry, that I was undisciplined, irresponsible, had no character. That's what I believed. And from that point on, that my life was just a chaotic mess. It just went from bad to worse. And I finally wound up, it really looked like just an avalanche. I was just a guy. I work with a lot of people. Don't mind if I take my coat off. And I won't start preaching, but that's maybe. Yeah, great. I'll just throw it there and I won't lose it that way. It's warm in Georgia. I was, where was I? Wrong. Oh. Yeah, and would wake up and beat myself. Thank you, Pat. I appreciate that young memory. I wake up, beat myself up, and would think about what happened. Now, I work with a lot of people, and honestly, a lot of them are not like me. They're folks who anguish over their drinking. Yeah, I've worked with many people who beat themselves up and say, man, this drinking is killing me. I'm one that I don't believe until I got sober, I ever fully gave responsibility for what happened to me to my drinking. I was not the kind of guy that anguished over his drinking. I anguished over stuff. I wake up on Monday morning trying to come alive and see if I get in shape to go to work and be worshiping over the porcelain throne and throwing up my toenails and my eyes run out on their stem. And I'm just sweating and shaking and dying. And you doggone right, I had some moments of anguish thinking of, geez, I'm not going to drink that stuff anymore. And for fleeting moments get so desperate that I would say in all earnestness, God, just get me through this. And you ain't got to worry about this boy no more. I won't do it. I won't do this anymore. And meant it and wouldn't till about 5 o'clock. And then the neon lights would come on. And when those suckers would flash, they were saying, Tom, come on, boy. Hey, Tom, come on, something going on. And I was gone again. And I just didn't understand that for me the issue was not a lifestyle. It was what happened if I took one drink. I didn't understand that. And so it just fell apart. I took off. I never really looked back. I didn't anguish over what was going on. I just never looked back. I got so caught up in it, I was so busy doing it, that I didn't even think about what was happening. Except that I knew my life wasn't working too good. And I to understand my alcoholism, all I have to do is look at the two extremes. Look at that bright-eyed fellow, bounced out of high school up in North Carolina, 16 years old, went off to conquer the world. And contrast him to the fellow who 8 short years later was living on the streets up in the city of Flint, Michigan. Now, that's where booze took me. Now, I kid around a little bit about my alcoholism, but God knows I never want to forget the nature of that disease in my life. I never want to get to thinking that my alcoholism was just some cute little inconvenience, that it was just some transitory problem of a problem-ridden kid, that it was just some relief of a painful life. I don't ever want to get to thinking that it was some situational passing thing. Never want to forget that for this guy, when I talk about alcoholism, I'm talking about a deadly disease. And I have absolutely no doubt it would have killed me as a young man if I hadn't been brought to a stop. And it took me down in a hurry. I wound up living on the streets. And I hope to my God that I never forget that kind of a meaningless, totally lost existence. I never want to forget what it felt like to walk on the face of this earth and have no place to call home. To have no place where I belong, no place where I fit. I never want to forget that lost, empty, desolate feeling. I never want to forget the feeling of constant embarrassment and shame just for the way I was. I never want to forget the the indignity of playing the buffoon or playing the idiot in a bar so somebody would buy me a drink. Cribbing drinks, hustling strangers, rolling other drunks. Never want to forget that. Never want to forget the feelings associated with it. Never want to forget what it was like to sell my life's blood. $5 a throat. That's what my kind did to survive. That's what I did. Never want to forget that kind of existence and the absolute miracle of my recovery. Because that's exactly where it took me, and I think it's where it would take me tonight if I took one drink. Now, I wish I could tell you that one bright day I just looked at it, had enough, called for help, and got okay. Didn't happen that way with me, and most of you know, or many of you know, that mine was one of those cases that was to involve great tragedy, not in terms of what happened to me, but in terms of what I did. I've never met an alcoholic that can't identify with my experience, and yet, thank God, most don't have it. I think every alcoholic I've ever met has had a very chronic fear that they may wind up hurting somebody else in a way that couldn't be undone. Thank God, most don't. But some do. For some, that's just a bad dream. For others, it's a nightmare. And I was one of those that woke up one morning in jail, in the city of Flint jail I'd been in many, many times, and took it for granted. I was in there for the same as always and was greeted with the fact that the night before, driving somebody's car down the main street of the city and ran down and killed two people. And my reaction to that was like any rational humans would be. Just shock and disbelief. I couldn't handle it, couldn't deal with it, couldn't accept it, and then gradually came to know that indeed I had done more damage than any drunk ever would be allowed to do. Stayed in there 76 days, didn't want out, was afraid to get out. Then somebody found out who I was and where I was from and contacted with my folks down in Carolina and they came and got my release on bond. Charged with manslaughter. Stayed in there 76 days before I was released. I knew during that time I wouldn't drink. I knew I couldn't drink again. Got out, stayed sober a day and a half, and then, of course, I drank. And from July to November of 56, drank like no human I've ever seen. And I mean that. I don't mean any Wild West kind of thing. I mean, I was a guy who was pathologically drinking, obviously trying to drink myself to death. And clearly that didn't happen. Then November the 19th of 56 was the date of what I hope and pray was my last drink. Didn't know it was going to be, but I knew it was going to be the last one for a long time, because that day I was going in to be tried on the charge of manslaughter. And then there was no trial. I mean, they had no defense. I couldn't even tell them what I'd done. They had to tell me. And I was naturally found guilty. Sentenced that day to a max of 15 years in state prison, Michigan State Penitentiary. I knew what that meant. You know, I mean, when you're a street character, you know that going to jail is an occupational hazard, and penitentiary looms ever near. But I never really believed I'd go to any place like that. And sure enough, that's what happened. I found myself the next day sitting in the largest walled institution in the world, Jackson Prison. Absolutely resigned to my fate, absolutely resigned to the fact that I would never come out of there alive. Little did I know that a brand new way to live would start right there. A little social worker referred me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never heard the words to my knowledge. I'd never even heard of anybody helping a drunk. You know, a very significant thing to me in a workshop I was in this afternoon, somebody used the old term of being friendly with our friends. Recognizing how instrumental people outside this fellowship are in getting folks to this fellowship. A little rookie social worker referred me to Alcoholics Anonymous, probably never been to a meeting. And I've never looked back, never had a drink since. A remarkable kind of thing. Now, he didn't influence that, but he got me in the place where recovery happens. And I walked into my first meeting, didn't particularly want to go. I really think the basic reason I went was, I don't know if you can identify with this or not, but I had no fight left. You know, I mean, I was just done. I was just a noodle. I was just wiped out, and I had no resistance. And walked into that first meeting having no earthly idea what to expect, and sat down and listened to the first alcoholic I ever heard tell his story. A man named Shy Walker became my sponsor, became a man that I loved dearly, and he introduced me to this program. I was 24 years old. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I'd been in trouble all of my life with booze. I didn't really believe that. I thought I was too young to be alcoholic. I didn't think anybody could be alcoholic at 24. On the inside, what I really believed was that I was a world beater who never had the right break. That's really what I believed. I really believed if I could ever get started out on the right foot, look out world, boy, I'd be okay. That's really what I believed. I didn't think I was alcoholic. I knew that I didn't particularly want to be sober. But, you know, when I heard people start talking about being sober for the rest of their lives, now I'll guarantee you, now I don't know about anybody else, but mine was not some feeling of yearning hope. My God, who wants to be sober the rest of their life? I could barely handle 8 hours. That had no appeal to me. Yeah, I thought that would be like a life of purgatory, of painful boredom, you know. So that had no real appeal to me. Most people I'd ever seen who were sober, I kind of felt sorry for them. I mean, they just looked like sad sacks to me. I didn't want to be drunk either, you know. But there was, if they could have just found a way to be about halfway between the two conditions, that's where I'd be tonight, I tell you that. I ain't here on moral ground, you know. I just couldn't function there. But that's the kind of guy I was. You know, I was just sort of sitting there listening to this stuff. It didn't mean anything. You know, it was just words and stuff. And the remarkable thing is that I kept going back. I kept going back. I never missed a meeting the entire time I was in that institution. Never missed a meeting. And certainly it was not because of any significant thing that happened. I didn't identify with the first guy that spoke nor the 50th guy that spoke. It was a long time before I ever identified with a single person who came into that institution who said they were alcoholic. I said I was because I hated to be the only one in there that was under the heading of other, you know. So I'd say, yeah, me too, you know. Didn't mean anything. It was a word. And I thought many, many times about what it was that turned the key. Now, here, not only was I a guy who didn't have any burning desire to be sober the rest of his life, not only was I a guy who didn't believe he was alcoholic, not only was I a guy who couldn't relate any of this to his life, but I was operating under an absolute mountain of guilt, a mountain of guilt. I felt so utterly ashamed to even be breathing, much less reaching out for hope or help. And when I think about the fact that I've never looked back, that I found a brand new way to live, new and different than anything I've ever known, it simply adds to my belief that there is a miraculous phenomenon that we call recovery that comes out of the principles of this program. Yeah, I think about that many times, and I try to realize what happened. And I think there were a lot of things that happened. I really appreciated sitting in the corrections workshop this afternoon and listening to the kind of people who made the difference in my life. Of people who walked into the institution and stuck out a hand and said something to me that I'd never heard before in a language that I understood. And I'm not talking about gutter language. I'm talking about genuine communication, one drunk to another. I'd never heard stuff like that. And I came into contact with people who reached out a loving, accepting hand to me when I had absolutely nothing to put in it but a broken and wasted life. I could no longer get caught up in the notion that the guy's got an angle. He wants something from me. God knows, I hope that I never forget for one second the tremendous value of what one drunk communicates to another. Jack and I were talking when we had coffee before the meeting about the enormous power of one alcoholic story, of an alcoholic story. There is absolutely nothing that conveys the trust that's so essential for recovery than one drunk telling his story. Now, I'm a guy who fully believes that every alcoholic, Al-Anon or Alateen, has a story that somebody needs to hear, that nobody else's. Somebody needs to hear it that nobody else's will quite reach. And I think one of the obligations we have is to share it. You know, when I think back, I don't mean to be philosophical about this, but you know, one of the things I've come to believe, that, you know, why is it that some of us make it and so many of us don't? Now, I'm no fount of wisdom on that, but let me tell you what I've come to believe. And I relate that to my experience in those early days there. I believe there are two things that are essential. For, not just for me, but I mean for every alcoholic I've ever known anything about. One, I believe that a thing called bottom is absolutely essential. I don't think there's any shortcut to it. I think every alcoholic who is going to recover must reach a point where that person gets as low as they want to go. It has nothing to do with station, status, don't have to go to the street, don't have to sell your blood. It has to do with that absolute recognition of defeat. I'm beat. I think that's essential. Obviously, it isn't enough. Because I hit bottom dozens, maybe hundreds of times. When I would have those fleeting moments when I was down, no question about it. I'm convinced that if somebody had effectively conveyed a solution to me, I might have recovered much sooner. I believe that. But I think that's essential. It is not enough because even though I did it hundreds of times, I went right back and drank again. So it's clearly not enough. The other thing has to happen. I believe that a solution has to become known to me. I don't mean told to me. I don't mean sent to me or read to me. I believe a solution has to become known to me. And that's what's so essential about an alcoholic effectively conveying the language of the heart, sharing his own experience. You know, there's a fallacy about folks going into correctional institutions that I think is a fallacy. And the fallacy is that there's some strange language necessary to reach people in institutions. Let me tell you something, this guy's come to believe. I don't think there's any special language. When I go into a correctional institution, I'll tell you something I do. I'm always fairly careful about my language because I don't need to pollute my story with a bunch of gutter talk to make a point. So I'm always careful about my language. I respect the forum. I'm even more careful when I go into a correctional institution. Even more careful. I'm about as squeaky clean as you can get when I go into a correctional institution. And I talk as straight and as honest and as clean as I know how. Tell you something else that I try to do. I don't talk to convicts when I go in to correctional institutions in an AA meeting. I talk to alcoholics. It's a thing that I came to understand about the nature of this disease. When I first started contemplating the fact that I might be alcoholic, what I based that on was that my life was a mess. I was in trouble. I was in a maximum custody penitentiary, so obviously I must be alcoholic. I think that's only 180 degrees wrong. I wasn't alcoholic because I was in a maximum custody penitentiary, because I killed somebody, because I threw up every time I drank. That's not why I was alcoholic. I did those things because I was alcoholic, just the other way around. I was in a maximum custody penitentiary as a result of my alcoholism. Sounds like a little tricky play on words, but I think there's something fundamentally important about that. So when I go into a correctional institution in an AA meeting, I talk to alcoholics. There's the language of the heart. I don't need to get into some kind of school ground, off-wall language thinking I'm going to impress somebody and carry a message. So, exposure to a solution. And when I think back, I think one of the great rewards that I had by being in the situation I was in is that I had a prolonged enough period of a clear demonstration of bottom that I had time to see a solution. And I saw that solution in the people who walked into my life and gave me an undeserved demonstration of affirmation, those people who came in and reached out to me. Let me tell you one other way that I think the key was turned for me. I I'm not sure where this term comes from, but it makes eminent sense to me. When I think of what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about, a term that comes to mind is experiential learning. Experiential learning. That in this program, I learned by barrelhead experience. Barrelhead experience. By close duking out and working out and banging out with other people. And when this meeting ends tonight, 30 minutes after the meeting, most folks, including me, won't be able to recall anything much about what I said. It ain't the Sermon on the Mount. It's a drunk telling his story. Now, if it has meaning, you may remember a warm feeling. You may feel a sense of identity. The spoken word is one of the most inefficient ways of communicating there is. I have hard time. You heard me lose it a while ago while I was talking. My God. It's a very elusive thing. One of the places where I really cut my teeth. I was fortunate to be in an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. An excellent group. The recovery group in Jackson Prison was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by that I mean it was a group that didn't treat recovery as some mysterious occurrence. It was a group that took the time to introduce its members to what this program is about. To what the program of recovery is about and how it works. And you know, we say sometimes, half in jest and half seriously, we don't know how this program works. It just works. Well, that's a nice thing to say, but it's kind of dumb, really. That is just not true. You know, this program, let me tell you, give you exactly what I'm talking about. Now, I'm a manager. I've been a manager for 30 years. And in business, I operate by plans and objectives and budgets and projections and data and all that kind of stuff. You have to. You have to. You've got to put your plans in place or you'll never get there. Would you believe that in 30 years as a manager, I have never seen an operating plan as clearly detailed as the plan of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I mean that. I mean that. If you wonder about that, I would invite you the next time you pick up the big book, look at it as critically as you can. Rarely do I see a business plan that tells me precisely what to do, that gives me methods of measuring each step of the way. You heard Mike read a very definitive statement that comes at the end of number 9, of step 9. That said, if we're painstaking with 50% of this, we'll be amazed. And it tells precisely what will happen. And I can evaluate. The same thing occurs throughout the program. Very clear and logical thing. Now, I'm in the middle. I'm not a mechanic. I know that better today than I have ever known it. As somebody, I found out why. Somebody gave me a big German car that was older than me. And I wanted to fix the dude. Well, as not being a mechanic, I bought a very expensive book, you know, a big book. And it said stuff like, turn screw A into bolt B, now dummy. You know, stuff like that. About that basic. So I do that, and then it skips something, you know, and nothing makes sense, you know. And I wind up wanting a hammer. I want to beat that sucker to death. Thought I had it yesterday and was driving down the expressway. Something fell out on the highway. Thank God the big book ain't like that. It's the most logical design for living that I've ever seen, bar none, including management by objective. One of the places that I cut my teeth in Alcoholics Anonymous was in every group. You know, it's just like the reason I like to meet with a group like this. This is predominantly a bunch of folks who are in the heart of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are the folks who are going to help stay the course and keep this program where it belongs. You're the folks that are studying and looking for new ways, looking for ways to do it better. Every group has such a group. Not everybody in it is that way. The recovery group at Jackson Prison was a group like that. And I think back and remember the tremendous value. Now, that was an institution with 6,000 yo-yos in it. And there were 300 in my group. And every night, there would be about 8 or 10 of us out on a maximum custody penitentiary yard, would find a corner somewhere and sit down and relate to each other the nuances of how the program of recovery works. God, how valuable that was. How valuable it was to start experientially learning what the program of recovery is about. You know, that, we talked just a little bit about the state, you know, where we are. I really am sorry to say that with some notable exceptions, I believe that probably 80% of the people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous today don't get anywhere near that quality of introduction. I'm sorry, but that's the case, I believe. And what I mean by that is that all too often what we get is somebody walking into a huge group, particularly in metropolitan areas. Somebody walking into a huge group, and the odds are they won't even get recognized. They won't even get greeted. They'll walk into groups so big that you can just get sort of lost in the crowd. And if you get anything, it's something like, keep coming back, we meet again next week, come on back, see you then. Or go to 90 meetings in 90 days, or whatever. Some kind of cockamamie thing. Give you an example of what I'm talking about. I had a 12-step job just a while back. A guy knew, and he got drunker than a billy goat. Came back, and I got him ready to go to a meeting, sort of. He was ready. I was readier than he was, but he went. And looking for a beginner's group was what he needed. He'd been listening to me for 2 or 3 hours. So we found one that said they had a beginner's group, walked in, huge meeting, almost big as this. And when they started to break up, they broke up into small groups, theoretically. And so they called for that to happen, and about 85 people stayed in the beginner group. My God, there are people now older than me in the beginner group. And so they proceeded to have a beginner meeting that had nothing to do with beginners, that had nothing to do with hanging on for a day, for how to avoid a drink, for the critical stuff you have to learn. And I sat there just stewing, thinking, God, why didn't somebody? He's been listening to me for 3 hours. I don't want him to be listening to me some more. I want somebody to talk some beginner talk. It finally dawned on me, if you want to hear it, say it. So I stuck my hand up and started talking beginner talk. Remarkable thing happened. Keep this in mind when you get into a meeting that's missing it about as far as you can get away from what you're after. I shared just a little bit, and you could watch it ripple through the crowd. You could see people, and I didn't say anything all that marvelous. I was just talking about puking and drinking and stuff, you know, and brand new people stuff. And the whole group turned around and said, who is this guy? And you realize that probably 2/3 of the people in the group had the same frustration I did. They went looking for a newcomer meeting. But what they got was just a warm, general discussion. Didn't get a newcomer meeting. And once I started the ball rolling from that point on, it became a beginner's meeting. A huge beginner's meeting, but it got on track. And that's all too often what we run into. I rarely write anything down, but I just wrote something down so I would forget it. Wouldn't forget it. That, you know, what is it that worries me? I'd like to sort of buy you into some worry with me a little bit. And then overall, I don't have any bad news. Overall, I've got great news. But I'm not a dummy. And I have some concerns, and I know you have concern. And I know you got a guy sitting right here that led a charge on one of the concerns, and a gal right there that led one at the national level on some concerns we've got. I'm not unique in this. But let me share with you some concerns and see if you don't share them, let me ask you to consider. Now, what is it that worries one guy in Alcoholics Anonymous? What is it that makes me less optimistic than I want to be when I look at Alcoholics Anonymous. I worry about, for example, our primary purpose. I worry about how well we stick to our business of doing what we do better than anybody else in the world. And that's carrying the message to another alcoholic, period. That's our purpose. That's our only purpose. That's why we gather here tonight. That's why we cut watermelons in July. We never meet that it isn't for that purpose. If it isn't for that purpose, we need to examine why we're meeting that day. I met last night up in Chapel Hill. Now, that's a strange piece of North Carolina. I don't know, it doesn't look like North Carolina. It's at the university, and there was a guy called me that I hadn't seen for 32 years and said, come speak to my group. And I said, I'll do it. Met it. Said, I don't recognize this program anymore. I don't recognize it. I don't know how to relate to the people here. These aren't the people I left. What's going on? And we chatted a bit. When you walk into a meeting where the primary purpose is so obscured it's almost lost. I walk into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that bear no resemblance to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That get so far afield you couldn't remotely tie them in to the principles of this program. Our primary purpose is essential, is critical. I worry about, I'm reinforced a bit by here. You guys have done a good job in Georgia. You've done a good job. You've done a good job with your convention. You've done a good job with service. You've had some excellent leadership. You've done some good stuff. Let me tell you, this is not typical. There are sections of this country where at an assembly you can hold it in the phone booth, where there are vast areas totally unrepresented. I worry a lot about the diminishing service ethic in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worry a great deal about starting to lose the notion that service is vital to recovery, that service is the heart of this program. I worry a great deal. Now, I understand the human phenomenon, but we observe it in Alcoholics Anonymous. The closer you get to the work, the smaller the craft. That's a human phenomenon, but it's contrary to what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. And as I look at this program today, as I travel around, what I see is a very weakened kind of service ethic. I fear that it may not survive, the ethic of service. And if it doesn't, I don't think we will. I worry about specialty groups. Now, I'm a guy that, for obvious reason, I'm a fellow who has a very strong commitment to correctional facilities work. I think you always have a strong allegiance to where you found it. So I have a strong allegiance to that. But you can hurry up and believe I would not even consider joining a group of ex-cons anonymous. I have no interest in that. What this program is about is not some furtive hiding place. Bill talked about it. Joe, you probably heard him. He talked about the role of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to form some subculture so you can hide out. The function of this program is to restore us to our rightful place in life, to make us part of a community, to make us part of the human race. And I would submit to you that part of the power of our program is its diversity. As I've heard it called, this beautiful mosaic called Alcoholics Anonymous. When you can take a look out and you see a guy still got his coat on, and you see somebody else with cutoffs, you see somebody broke and somebody poor, somebody smart and somebody dumb, somebody black and somebody white, somebody gay, somebody straight, I would submit to you that the power of this program is in that. And when I start looking more and more for people like me, I think I will jeopardize the very thing that makes me a whole member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I have no interest in specialty groups at all. None. I don't even want one that's the true, true believers group. I won't. I just want to be in the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I worry about that a little bit. I worry about meetings versus groups. There are, in my area is one of them. I guarantee my home group ain't one of them. But my area is one where I have a suspicion that if you rang a bell at a given time and said, everybody go to your home group, we'd have some empty buildings. I mean, we got places that just where drunks bunch up and romance the problem and call it a meeting. And it bears no semblance to a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a strong meeting person. I'm not totally against them, but I'm somebody who believes strongly in the value of home group membership. Yeah, I'm somebody who believes that... I'm somebody who believes that everybody's member is nobody's member, and that membership is going to be short-lived. What I believe about group, you know, I believe in the group karma, so to speak, that my group goes with me. My group's with me now. I belong to the big group of Alcoholics Anonymous, Southern Pines. That's my home group. That's a part of my identity. If you ask me who I am, and I'm trying to tell you who I am, I'll tell you my name's Tom Iverson. I'll tell you what I do for a living. I'll tell you about my family. I will tell you about my home group because that's a part of who I am. I belong there. That's a part of me. And that's where my real responsibility lies in Alcoholics Anonymous. My fundamental allegiance is to that home group. Now, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I have a place that's home. And when that group gets in trouble, it's my trouble. Very important kind of thing for me. I'm a guy... I heard Raymond talking about how much he appreciated seeing the archives. He's here for his first assembly. Talked about how he appreciated seeing the archives. I see a revitalization of archives, and thank God, I hope it's here in time, because the history of our program is an elusive thing, but I think it's a tremendously important thing. And if we forget our history, I suspect that it will be jeopardy for this program. So I see a revitalization of that. Ain't totally happy yet. Now, wait a minute. I can see you. This is kind of tricky to talk about, and I don't mean to be ugly about it. I just mean to tell the truth about it. I think fundamentally one of the things that worries me greatest about Alcoholics Anonymous is a thing that I think, I characterize it as hardening of the attitudes. Hardening of the attitudes. When I take a look, and I don't mean to talk about the good old days, because I think the good old days are still here, if I let them be. But there was a time when the value existed that I needed the new alcoholic more than he needed me. Now, I don't think that value is prevalent anymore. I know sponsors who operate by appointment, you know, that I will see you next Tuesday at 1:30. Yes. I don't really believe that's the spirit of the program. Harden your attitude. What am I talking about? Take a look. Maybe your own group. Take a look at how your group is dealing with folk who come out of treatment centers who don't know what to call themselves. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with folks who get caught up in the criminal justice system and get directed there by a court? I'll tell you what I saw in David Town, Little Rock, Arkansas. I was sitting there one afternoon at a noon meeting. And I sort of played fly on the wall. I didn't know too many people. I just sort of watched something. They had a procession of court cases that came in. They had a strange way of dealing with it. They had a little state, little podium-like thing out there where the leader of the meeting sat. And it was almost like a ritual. I bet it was known by every drunk in Little Rock. When they walked in, and I watched it. When they walked in, I watched one guy in particular for the whole time. When he walked in, he took his little piece of paper, went up, and he laid it on the desk, just like a ritual. Laid it on that desk with the others, went back and sat down. We met on the fifth step. Finished the meeting, he walked up, picked up his paper, and walked out. Suppose one of his bottle buddies would have said, "Where you been?" What do you reckon he'd have said? Let me tell you what I believe. The next guy who walks in my group is not a nuisance. The next guy who walks in my group is not an interruption. He's not a distraction. He is my lifeline to recovery. The minute that I start sitting in judgment and elevating myself above the guy who gets caught up in a system he can't control and gets driven in here, and I start taking it out on him, that's what I'm talking about by hardening of the attitudes. And I'm one who believes that our program can't function with that kind of an attitude. When I get to a point that I have those kinds of hostile feelings about my fellow alcoholic, that's trouble, I believe. I don't care where he comes from. When I work with the new people in my group, I coordinate the newcomers program. And one of the things I say to that group every time I do the session, two things, and I mean it. One is that I'll get more out of the meeting than they will. And second is that I need them more than they need me. And I say that knowing they're not going to believe it, but because I need to remind myself of that over and over again. When I came into this program, I was treated with utmost dignity and respect. I was treated lovingly by total strangers. Saved my life. My commitment is that I want to do everything that I can to see that each person who walks into my group feels the same way. I want him to know that. That's the very least I can do. So a hardening kind of thing that I see. I worry about support, Joe, the thing you talked about. We ain't fixed yet. I worry about a fellowship in which half of us don't even contribute to our own support. I worry about that. I worry about a fellowship whose revenue comes from sources other than Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been in towns where they were putting on meetings like this, and they literally raised money by going out and asking merchants to donate. Literally. Not even understanding the problem with it. I worry about a fellowship because one thing that's fundamental to me getting sober is that I've got to stand up and take responsibility. I've got to start being accountable for, as a person, I think we do as a fellowship. So I still worry about that a great deal. I worry about undercover meetings. What am I talking about? Big movement. You probably got it in some of the larger, like Atlanta and some of the larger cities here. There is a movement, it's been written up a bit in the fellowship, I've seen it, of people who have just grown sick and tired of the furor in local meetings, who have literally gone underground and meet like moles, you know, they just sort of hide and meet. It has no relationship to anything about Alcoholics Anonymous other than in that one group. I saw that, I won't name the town, but I saw that in a city. Somebody told me about it at a place in a big city out west. And the lady told me that she thought about 75% of the people in that city went to such meetings. Criteria was that they had to be sober a year before they were invited to go. And that a huge number of people went. And I really found it kind of shocking. I said, "Well, that's really interesting. What about the folks who don't have a year? Where do they go?" And she said, "Well, there's a club downtown, and I guess they go down there. I've never been." I said, "Who works with them?" And she had a kind of a concerned look for a minute. And she said, "Golly, I guess they work with each other." You understand what I'm talking about? Because when I get moved so that I've got to have some rarefied atmosphere to function in so that drunks can't find me, I suspect there's big trouble in that. Yeah. I worry about sponsorship. There are vast areas of this country where there's not even a pretense of sponsorship, even weak. And it's vital to the survival of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mentioned this last thing. And it has to do with that kind of hardening of attitudes. You know, I mentioned hearing that term earlier in the workshop about being friendly with our friends. I hope that you've got, I know Brookings is involved in CPC and PI. CPC, I guess it is. I hope that you guys have got a vital thing going with that. Because the characteristic relationship that we have with people outside of Alcoholics Anonymous is antagonism. Antagonism. Most places that I go, you spend a great deal of time caught up in discussing what's wrong with the treatment center that's over the hill. What's wrong with the court? What's wrong with this and that? Rather than trying to understand what it is that needs to happen in terms of a cooperative relationship. And that same kind of hardened attitude, I suspect, is a tough thing to deal with. Well, there's a lot more that we could talk about that are troubling kinds of things. And I'm very, very pleased and grateful that I went into a group of Alcoholics Anonymous, even though it was in a penitentiary, and was able to get introduced to a program that was real. And this thing slowly but surely came alive for me. In those first few months in the program, I was a guy that was just sort of hanging on and hoping against hope. And then there came a time when I became a solid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, I don't mean to oversell this, but for me, the true turning point where it solidified. You know, I think everything that happened was essential. Those meetings out under the trees with the guys were essential. But I tell you the thing that turned the trick for me, and then we're going to head for the home stretch. I went to a meeting one day, and the guy spent the entire meeting talking about nothing but the inventory, the fourth step. Went into great detail. Talked about the value of writing. Went back to my cell, said, okay, I'm going to write. Now, what I meant to do was write a little story about what a victim of circumstances I was and how sad life was. That's what I meant to do. But the founders were wise when they said to write it, because rather than doing that, I wrote about two lines of that stuff, all at once started to write about me. Now, a lot of people say it's hard to take a fourth step, maybe so. Once that started with me, I couldn't have stopped if I'd have wanted. It was like a dam broke, and it was an absolute torrent as just painful, stored up things just poured out. Wrote three pages. And I tell you, it was not a very cute inventory by comparison with the book. Wasn't that kind. But I'll tell you this, it was the most important day's work this old boy's ever done in his life, bar none, before or since. Most important I've ever done. Because from that day to this day, I have never doubted the nature of my disease. Never once. Come close to drinking a few times, but never once for the old delusion. Maybe as importantly, that's where I became a genuine member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from that day to this day, I've never gone to a meeting that I didn't understand why I was there. I understand why I'm here tonight. You know, I'm not here to entertain, educate, shock, or worry. I'm here basically because I've learned that this is vital to my being able to function like I want to function in Alcoholics Anonymous. I carry out a responsibility. I have a great time in the process. God forbid I ever get to thinking I'm some kind of missionary that's got to go out and save the world. No, I'm just one drunk with one set of experience to share. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. Yeah. That grew out of that. Yeah, I know why I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand what I am in this program. That's where mature sobriety started to occur. And from that point on, it was amazing what happened. Yeah, I came alive in that institution. If anybody ever had to wonder about the power of this program, first day of freedom I ever knew in my entire life was in a maximum custody penitentiary, locked up like a monkey in a zoo, and knew freedom. I learned that freedom's not a physical thing, it's a spiritual thing, and I became free. I got turned on to life in that institution. Yeah, it's amazing what you find underneath a drunk when he starts getting recovered. It's amazing what you find. It's amazing the kinds of tastes and talents that emerge. And I got imbued with the notion that I might be able to live again. I got stimulated about living. I became a functioning member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got excited about some stuff. I enrolled in Michigan State University. They wouldn't let me go to class, but I was willing. They sent it to me. They just invented television, I guess. And they said it to me, and I finished 2 years of my college education in that institution. It really came alive. And then when I left, it was just a matter of keeping on, keeping on. And you know, the thing that I found, I mentioned that I don't have any bad news. I've got some concerns, of course, and I'm trying to address those the best I can, just as one guy. I do it in my home group. On balance, if anybody had ever told me, I could not have believed it. But what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, what's happened to this guy over the years? The day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I literally started the greatest adventure I could imagine. And I mean that. Now, I don't mean I've just had fun and gone to a lot of meetings. I started an absolute adventure in living, beyond anything I could imagine. I've had experiences that defy my imagination. I've had experiences that I wouldn't have even dared consider having. And it's just come my way. Just by plugging in, and all I did was just turn a broken, wasted life over to this simple program, and it gave me back a brand new way to live that's full of fun and worthwhile stuff. And there's a line in the introduction of the 12 and 12 that, I'm not a great quoter, but this one, the message sticks with me. It says, our program is a set of principles, spiritual in nature, that if practiced will free the sufferer of the obsession to drink and give him a life that's useful and whole. And that's not a shallow promise. That's exactly what happens. And I thought a lot of times about, what was it, what is it that produces the adventure? Where does it come from? Now, I'm singing to the choir to tell you guys, because you're already picking at it or already having it. But let me just say it for the record anyway. Where does it come from? What is it that makes the difference between just a mundane existence in AA and a thriving, vital kind of thing that really makes a difference? I ran into an old buddy a while back I hadn't seen for a long time. Been gone for 20 years, I guess. We greeted each other, and I said, "Hey, guy, where you been?" And he said, "Well, golly, I don't know. All my old buddies died, and I just kind of drifted away." And I said, "Well, that's interesting." And he said, "What about you?" And I said, "Man, that hadn't been my experience at all." And he said, "How come?" I said, and it kind of startled me a minute. I hadn't thought about it. I said, "Well, you know, my old buddies died too. They were the same buddies. But I got a whole brand new bunch of buddies." And to me, that's the key to this thing. It's about staying dynamically involved. And I'm a guy who's had a tremendous experience of being a functioning member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really think it has to do with the notion of being extremely unfamiliar with the word no. With the word no. I believe that in everybody's recovery, if I can just be general and broad just for a minute, I believe in the recovery of every alcoholic, Al-Anon or Al-Ateen, there will come a time when an avenue of service will open. It'll become known to you. And I believe without any question that the quality of my recovery, without question, the quality of my recovery, and perhaps even the quantity of it, will be directly affected by how I react when it appears. For example, if somebody asks me to speak at a meeting, my inclination will always be, I don't want to do it. I ain't quite ready. Somebody elects me to an office, and I say, I'm not ready for that. I've never had a job in Alcoholics Anonymous to this day that I felt ready for. Not one. I believe that what the growth process is about, what the adventure is about, is being willing to take that little step into faith and letting the process work. My basic notion is that the program of recovery has to match the way I drank. Now, I was not the kind of guy that would tippy-tippy-toe down to the bar and have a few little drinky poos and tippy-tippy-toe back to the house. That wasn't me. Now, if that was me, it may be quite adequate to just tippy-tippy-toe down to the group and then back. But I ain't that kind of guy. Yeah, I got to have some action. Yeah, I got to have something going on. If ain't nothing going on, I'm going to make something happen. And that's kind of the way I look at Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that thing of being able to go in and be a dynamic member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me wrap up on a story here. David's story is experience. I'll tell you what I'm talking about with this. I went into a city just north of here, big city. Place had been lots of times. Walked into the club in the afternoon. Been there before. Didn't see anybody I knew. Walked in, it was a typical mid-afternoon club crowd. Bunch of guys playing cards, dominoes, shooting a bull. And I did this deliberately. I went around and physically brushed against everybody in the club. Shouldn't have mattered, but I was dressed decently. Shouldn't have mattered, but it might. I physically brushed against every person in there. Not a soul spoke. Not one. Went back to the coffee place and the guy was talking to another fellow. A few minutes he came over and said, "You want a coffee?" I said, "Yeah." Had a coffee, walked out. Went over to the hotel and bummed around a while. And then I was coming back to the club and I was going to a meeting. This time I walked in and I did what I normally do. I went to every table, interrupted every card game. I'm Tom Iverson from Alcoholic. They probably didn't care if I was Tom Iverson. But by golly, I did. I cared. And I care a great deal about my reception in Alcoholics Anonymous. I care a great deal about the atmosphere with which our program works. Introduced myself to everybody, shook every hand, whether they wanted it shook or not. And would you believe it was a different club? Warmest, friendliest bunch of guys you have ever seen in your life. I was going to meet and they asked me to take a brand new guy to a meeting. Who else are you going to ask? A dead man? You're going to ask the guy that's alive. That's exactly what I'm talking about. You got to make something happen. I don't go to bad meetings. I don't go to bad meetings. I go to some I don't particularly want to go back to, but I don't go to bad ones because I'm going to do my darndest to make something happen in that meeting. Yeah, make something happen that's going to bring it alive, at least for me. And that's sort of where the adventure comes from me. Let me ask you to consider doing this when you go back home. This sounds a little hokey if you're not used to thinking in these terms. But I think it's vital. I think it's vital that we have the energy and enthusiasm and spirit in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I think that's what drunks hang on to. I think it's what they hang on to. And let me encourage you to do this if you have doubts about it. If you don't think this works, when you go back home, when you go back to your area, pick a group. Pick the lousiest group you know. The one that you think ought to have its franchise revoked. You know what? And go over there, go over to that group one night, and do something that I often do. Just before you go in the door, stop in the parking lot and ask yourself, "Well, old boy, old girl, do you have anything to be grateful for?" Now, I don't know about you, but so far I have never had to say no, not one single time. And when I remind myself that I have something to be grateful for, then I say, act like it. Act like it. Go into that meeting and welcome the dudes to their own group. Welcome them. You'll be amazed what happens. Thank you.